day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Vicor earnings results for the second quarter ended June 30th, 2016 conference call. My name is Tawana, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session. If at any time you require operator assistance, please press star zero and an operator will be happy to assist you. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host for today, Mr. Jamie Sims, CFO. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Vicor's conference call for the second quarter ended June 30th, 2016. I'm Jamie Sims, CFO, and with me here in Andover are Patrizio Vinciarelli, Chief Executive Officer, and Dick Nagel, Chief Accounting Officer. Today, we issued a press release summarizing our financial results for the quarter ended June 30th. This press release is available on the investor relations page of our website, vicorpower.com. We also have filed a Form 8-K with the Securities and Exchange Commission in association with issuing this press release. I remind listeners, this conference call is being recorded and it is the copyrighted property of Vicor Corporation. I also remind you various remarks we may make during this call may constitute forward-looking statements for purposes of the safe harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Our forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially from those explicitly set forth or implied in our statements. Such risks and uncertainties are discussed in the Form 10-K we filed with the SEC on March 8th, 2016. Please note the information provided during this conference call is accurate only as of today, Tuesday, July 26th. Vicor undertakes no obligation to update any statements made during this call, and you should not rely upon such statements after the conclusion of the call. A replay of today's call will be available beginning at midnight tonight through August 10th, 2016. The replay dial-in number is 888-286-8010, followed by the passcode 36834933. In addition, a webcast replay of today's call will be available shortly on the investor relations page of our website. I'll start this afternoon's discussion with a review of our financial performance for the second quarter and the first half of the year, and Patrizio will follow with his comments, after which we will take your questions regarding our business. For the second quarter, as stated in this afternoon's press release, Vicor recorded a net loss of $544,000, representing a net loss per share rounded to $0.01. For the prior quarter, we reported a net loss attributable to Vicor Corporation of $5.35 million, representing a net loss per share rounded to $0.14. Sequentially, a revenue increase of $6.9 million reduced our net loss by $4.8 million, a reflection of the production-related leverage in Vicor's operating model. For the first half of 2016, we recorded revenue of $99 million and a net loss of $5.9 million, representing a net loss per share of $0.15. In contrast, for the first half of 2015, we reported net income of $4.2 million, representing net income per share of $0.11. Recall results for the first quarter of 2015, in which we earned $0.09 per share, reflected the relatively high volume contribution of VR12.5 shipments for data center applications early that year. As addressed in this afternoon's press release, second quarter results reflected the recurring circumstances we have encountered for the last five quarters in terms of the negative influence on our revenue and profitability of the combination of delays in new programs and the general weakness of demand for our legacy products due to broad macroeconomic conditions. However, volume did improve sequentially as consolidated product revenue increased 15%, with improvement across all business units. Domestic revenue increased 11.2% sequentially, and international revenue, consisting of exports and the revenue of our Japanese subsidiary, rose 17.7%, reflecting a rise in shipments by VI Chip and Vicor of VR12.5 solutions to Asian contract manufacturers. Of note, consolidated turns volumes, that is, orders received and shipped within the quarter, returned to the level we've seen before the pronounced macroeconomic headwinds of Q4 2015 and Q1 2016. As we've discussed before, we consider turns to be only a coincident indicator of market health. However, we do know that sustained weakness in turns volume below a certain level is a red flag, so we are pleased to see this metric improve. Historically, turns volumes have been almost entirely related to BBU modules, but I should point out the calculation of turns for recent quarters has included a more meaningful contribution from VI chip due to shortened lead times for certain higher volume programs. Of course, shortened lead times are associated with higher efficiencies, which contribute to higher product gross margins. Concluding on consolidated revenue, recognized distribution revenue for the second quarter rose over 24%, with each of our stocking distribution partners recording improved results, with our new products representing a larger share of activity. Turning to product-level profitability, the increase in production volume and shipments contributed to a greater than 4-point increase in consolidated gross profit margin as a percentage of sales, which rose from 42% for Q1 to 46.2% for Q2. BBU module and configurable revenue increased by 8.3% sequentially, driving Andover's gross profit margin higher, primarily due to a rebound in shipments of bricks for industrial and transportation applications. The operational challenges associated with the consolidation of our six custom units into three wholly owned subsidiaries are behind us, and our custom revenue increased 36.5%, on track with forecasts. Combined gross margins for the three custom subsidiaries rose over 4 points, reflecting higher volumes. BJCL, our Japanese subsidiary, recorded a second consecutive quarter of higher dollar revenue, resulting from the 15% year-to-date appreciation of the yen to the dollar through June 30th. However, trading conditions in Japan remain challenging as yen revenue declined 2.3% sequentially, while gross margin declined over 3 points, despite lower yen costs to import our modules used in BJCL's product portfolio. VI chip revenue increased 37% sequentially, driving the unit's gross profit margin higher by over 8 points, primarily due to the aforementioned increases in shipments of VR 12.5 solutions and sustained volumes of older VI chip models for industrial and test instrumentation applications. This margin improvement occurred although we continue to operate well below capacity, supporting our expectation of further margin improvement for VI chip with the volumes we're forecasting for 2017. PICOR, our fabless IC subsidiary, experienced a 26% increase in revenue, reflecting its contribution of SIP regulator components to the increased volume of VR 12.5 deliveries. PICOR's new products also gained traction within our stocking distribution channel. PICOR's gross margins were largely unchanged for the quarter. Consolidated operating expenses only rose 1.3% quarter to quarter, and for the first half of 2016 were 2.3% or $1.2 million lower than the total recorded for the first half of 2015. Consolidated SG&A expenses rose 2.1% sequentially, while consolidated R&D expenses were flat, rising only 3-tenths of a percentage point. Within SG&A for the second quarter, the increase in revenue drove related variable expenses, notably commissions, which rose 10.7%. A sizable seasonal decline in audit costs and related accounting fees largely offset a seasonal rise in shareholder reporting costs tied to our annual shareholder meeting and the publication of our annual report and proxy, as well as anticipated increases in travel, advertising, and related sales and marketing costs. R&D costs saw a 4.6% sequential increase in prototype spending, but this was offset by reductions in spending across other categories. Our consolidated operating loss of $601,000 compared favorably to the $5.4 million operating loss recorded for the first quarter. As was the case the first quarter, our second quarter tax calculation did not reflect unusual or non-recurring activity. Turning to cash flow and our cash position, our second quarter net loss combined with a $4.5 million swing in working capital to cause a decline in our cash and equivalents of $5.6 million to $54.2 million. Capital expenditures for the second quarter rose to $2.8 million from the prior quarter's $1.9 million, higher than we had forecast as the timing of in-service dates for certain projects shifted. Recall we completed the build-out of our new VIA manufacturing line during the fourth quarter, and substantial construction retrofit projects continue. We continue to expect capital expenditures to remain in the recent range of plus or minus $2 million for the foreseeable future. Quality of our receivables portfolio remains excellent, with day sales steady at 46 days. Similarly, our aging schedule remains in very good shape with 97% of accounts under 60 days. We were in touch with our Turkish distributors last week and are comfortable with our modest exposure there. No other markets present a challenge or represent a concern for us at this time. Annualized turnover of consolidated inventories declined slightly from 4.7 to 4.5 times, reflecting an increase in raw materials held by VI Chip. No unusual or notable activity occurred in our inventory reserve accounts. Employee headcount as of June 30th was 1,013, of which 975 were full-time employees. This quarter, I will provide greater detail on the composition of changes to our headcount. Year-to-date, total headcount has increased by net 28, with the net addition of 11 full-time employees across the organization, a net reduction of 9 part-time employees, and a net increase of 26 co-op students typically involved in programming and IT support. The year-end cycling of these co-ops skewed the full-time and part-time figures I provided last quarter. Now I'll turn to bookings and our outlook for the third quarter. Bookings for the second quarter rose 7.2% sequentially to $52.5 million, the highest level in 5 quarters. Total BBU bookings rose 9% overall, with contributions from the Andover module business, our custom business, and VJCL, both in dollars and yen. VI Chip and PICOR bookings reflected the continued order flow, which had resumed in the first quarter, for VTM and PRM solutions for powering processors using the Intel VR 12.5 standard. Reflecting these orders, VI Chip bookings sequentially increased 7.1%. As I've described before, contract manufacturers frequently do not match VTM and PRM order volumes, and second quarter bookings for PICOR were again out of sync, with bookings declining 23%, after rising 87% for the prior quarter. With this mix of bookings, our consolidated book-to-bill ratio for the second quarter stood at just under 1-to-1. Backlog as we entered the third quarter totaled $30.3 million, a slight decline of 3% from the beginning backlog for the second quarter. We are expecting the improvement of turns volumes to continue, with their growth more than offsetting the slight decline in backlog scheduled to ship during the quarter. We also are expecting additional VR 12.5 orders through the first half of 2017 before the transition to Intel's VR 13 standard finally occurs. We have been successful in expanding our 48-volt to load solutions to additional server manufacturers for the new VR 13 standard and anticipate increasing orders and shipments to additional computing and networking customers to occur starting in 2017. As Patricio will address, our momentum in the 48-volt to point-of-load segment continues. Also, customer interest in our new chips and chips in VIA packages for a range of applications beyond computing is rapidly expanding. This is all very encouraging, but sales cycles for new disruptive products are unpredictable and can be long. Similarly, we cannot predict when macroeconomic conditions will generate confidence rather than uncertainty. As discussed before, our break-even quarterly revenue level is in the range of $53 million, depending upon product mix. As such, we expect to operate for the next two quarters close to break-even, given our backlog and the aforementioned turns expectations. However, major variables outside of our control include the timing of large new programs beginning to ramp. I'll now turn the call over to Patricio.
Thank you, Jamie. As Jamie noted, second quarter results reflected the rebound from the weak first quarter, which we believe represented a turning point in our long-term performance trend. He also spoke to the expanding level of market enthusiasm associated with a differentiated 48-volt direct to point-of-load solution, coming off a high-profile event earlier this year, notably the Open Compute Project Summit in March, at which Google affirmed its commitment to a 48-volt bus architecture for data centers. Momentum in other markets continues to build, with our expanding offering of high-performance power system building blocks, specifically chip modules and chips with NVIDIA platforms, for using applications for which their matched power density make them compelling, cost-effective alternatives to competing solutions in larger traditional form factors. As mentioned last quarter, we're actively engaged with our new products with customers in a range of promising markets, including electric vehicles, and within that field, autonomous vehicles in particular, LED lighting, and wireless telecommunications infrastructure. We also are seeing an acceleration in interest in our new products from customers in markets served by the BBU, as these customers undertake new designs of products in which our legacy bricks have been de facto standards. Our global teams are busy responding to interest, ranging from initial engineering inquiries to extensive design engagements. Our introduction of new products continues, contributing to the diversification of our customer base. Notably, just last month, we expanded our family of VIA package DCMs. DCMs are isolated, regulated DC-DC converters offering a matched power density. When deployed in our VIA package for either board or chassis mounting, these converters offer best-in-class performance and a high level of design flexibility. With our June introductions, we now offer DCM solutions for challenging defense electronics applications, complementing commercial offerings for communications, industrial, instrumentation, robotics, and transportation applications. The broadened DCM family is fully integrated into Vicor's power component design methodology, the basis of our strategy for the broad markets we serve. Our focus on an end-to-end modular power system design methodology is unique in the industry, as it provides system designers with predictable components and system functionality. Reliability, fast design cycles, easy system configurability, and scalability. Recognition of these unique power system capabilities is catching on across a broadening base of customers. I'll conclude my remarks, despite appropriate caution and conservatism regarding near-term financial results, by once again affirming my belief that Vicor is close to fulfilling its long-term vision of transforming our competitive landscape. Yes, macroeconomic uncertainty remains a challenge for our legacy products, and disruptive innovations have inherently uncertain sales cycles. However, with customers recognizing we have the right products, our momentum is finally building. I'm sure listeners have many questions, so I will open the call. Operator?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Questions will be taken in order received. Please press star 1 to begin. Your first question comes from the line of Jim Cartlett. Please proceed.
Patricio, last quarter you said you expected to see bookings take positive steps this quarter, the next quarter, and the quarter after that. As far as I can see, visibility is the same progression of the increasing bookings and shipments. I would take it from your more cautionary note this time that perhaps some of these just aren't projects aren't developing quite as rapidly and or more macro uncertain. Could you help me understand a little more about what's happening here?
Yes. So, by the way, we continue to expect increasing level of bookings and shipments quarter by quarter, as far as the eye can see. One thing, though, that has changed since last quarter is that we've been informed of further delays with the actual start date of the next generation VR-13, which, as many of us are painfully aware of, has kept, you know, pushing to the right with a high degree of unpredictability. Now, the silver lining is that delays in the ramp of the VR-13 are giving rise to new orders for VR-12 and a half. However, the offsetting element is that I think, as we've discussed in the past, with VR-13, we have a considerably broader customer base. So the makeup of VR-12 and a half sockets doesn't fully compensate for the delays with new projects, which are only going to be with us as of the time when VR-13 finally takes off. So to recap, we still believe that we saw a turning point in the revenue performance and bottom line performance by far of the company last quarter. We're still looking forward to increased bookings this quarter, the quarter after that, and as far as the eye can see. But the delay, with the further delay with VR-13, has mitigated the steepness of the ramp that is associated with those particular programs, which, as of last quarter, were anticipated to ramp at the end of the year, beginning of 2017, and they now appear to have been set back by another one or two quarters.
So now it's second quarter 17?
Well, as far as we can tell. And obviously, we've had, and we're not alone in this, it is not a predicament that is unique to us, but the industry at large. We've been surprised before, so I can't rule out the possibility that we could be surprised again. Now, again, to look at this in the grander contest, while VR-13 has been delayed again, it is being made up, at least in part, by continued shipments of VR-12 and a half products. And we are making progress and getting production orders with other programs that are in a different space or spaces and are unrelated to the vagaries of subsequent generations of processors. Needless to say, our strategy of diversification, both within the data center space in terms of the types of processors we power, and outside of the data center space in terms of the types of solutions that we offer in other markets, is aimed at limiting our dependency or significant dependency on any one single product generation introduction schedule, which unfortunately has been very unpredictable.
So that would mean that if potential new data center customers that were waiting, they were lined at the later for VR-13, so getting some of those new customers would have to wait for VR-13.
Yes, we have a broadened spectrum applications at the point of load associated with the R13 sockets, which unfortunately awaits the actual availability of these new processors.
Thanks for explaining.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of John Dillon. Please proceed.
Hi, Patrizio. I just want to go back to Jim's question a little bit more. So in your prepared remarks, you were talking about the unpredictable delays in the ramp of certain major new programs. So is that the VR-13 customers? Is that really what the delays are?
That's been the major factor.
Major. And I appreciate your answer to Jim. It makes a lot of sense. It's very hard to follow Intel because they have so many different iterations of the Skylake processor, and Skylake's really what's got the VR-13, but you're really looking for the server version of the Skylake, and there's all kinds of different versions of the server. So, I mean, is it really the Purley? Is that really what you're looking for, the Purley platform? Is it when that, because I think that's scheduled to come out second quarter of 2017.
I'm not going for a variety of reasons to comment on the specific type of processor in question. It may not be one only at play, given the diversity of applications that we have been pursuing. But
okay, so
I think
other.
Your general knowledge of delays that have occurred with respect to at least some, you can infer that we've been dependent and will continue to depend on when this processor will actually become available in volume.
Okay. What about memory sockets or other sockets? Are you getting any new memory or other sockets before the release of the VR-13?
So generally speaking, when it comes to other sockets that are related to the deployment of the new processors, as you can imagine, they are related to deployment of the new processor, and they are subject to corresponding unfortunate delays.
Okay, that makes sense. Because they're all in the same design. So in that, in light of that. When we're talking about design wins, have you lost any design wins that you've previously had because of some of the new competitors that are coming out with 48 volt, or do you still have all the design wins that you've had?
We have not lost any design wins. It is uncertain whether there is any real competitive product that is truly available, and with respect to that which has been projected as becoming available, the performance attributes of these projected products is well below the performance attributes of our existing products, never mind new products that we will be introducing relatively soon. So to be clear, our visibility is limited to what has been advertised as becoming available. We see no evidence of real-world availability, and even if that were to become real, that which is being projected in terms of density is far below the density of products, and in other performance attributes is also considerably less of a performer. So we don't feel in any way, you know, threatened by the competition. We believe that competition is good, particularly competition of this kind, where we have a very significant a performance advantage and we have a very good cost card. So we believe that the onset of a broader participation in the 48 volt to point of load applications broadening requirements by multiplicity of customers for these kinds of solutions is a development that will accelerate our revenue growth and profitability as we are positioned to capture a very good share of that market.
You know, that all makes a lot of that actually makes perfect sense to me. But what I think I'm hearing is that, you know, because of these delays, you've got a number of customers who are just lining up waiting for the VR13 to hit, and then they're going to be putting in their orders, and you're going to be starting shipping product. But like right now, you've got one basically data center that's taking the 12.5. You've got a multiple number who are going to be taking the 13. You've got additional lots that you're going to be taking over when the new 13 comes out, and you've got other customers that are coming on. You know, I almost feel like there's a dam here, and all your customers are backing up, and then all of a sudden, you know, the VR13 is going to be here, and you're going to see a very, very significant increase in your bookings and revenue. Am I on track with that, or can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think the comment I would make is that VR13 and the general evolution towards 48-volt based solutions is without question a great development for us. It's a perfect match for the strengths of our technology. Again, we have, particularly in terms of density, efficiency, low noise performance, which is more and more mission critical, and in other respects that I will not be specific about. Because of this variety of performance advantages and a very cost-effective card, this is a development that very much favors our opportunity. But I think it would be a mistake to put so much emphasis on just that end market. We made tremendous progress over the last couple of years with the expansion in our product portfolio in a number of different directions with other complementary products that make it more and more real for customers at large, and not just in the data center space, to architect their power system based on a combination of modular building blocks that Vicor uniquely makes. And these are front-end blocks. These are different kinds of point-of-load devices, including, in particular, whole family, expanding family of ZVS point-of-load regulators developed within Vicor. And other kinds of products, again, in the front-end space, DCMs, PFMs. These are building blocks which we've developed. These are families that have been expanding with, again, very differentiated performance attributes which meet the demands of customers in a variety of end markets. So we're finding ourselves in the catbird seat in a multiplicity of end markets, and we're applying all of our resources in the front end of the business, in the back end of the business, to pursue in a balanced way these multiplicity opportunities. And we can do it without spreading ourselves thin because of the unique methodology that we've developed in terms of being able to reuse the same power conversion engines, being able to reuse the same packaging technologies, the same manufacturing infrastructure. So we have the wherewithal to pursue a large multiplicity of opportunities with common denominator capabilities. And for that reason, it would be a mistake to, in effect, put all the focus in the data center space in server power. There's a lot more to the opportunity than just that.
Well, and again, that kind of goes to my question. The heart of my question is, it sounds like you can have, you know, increasing bookings and revenue for the next couple quarters, but then it sounds like there's a backlog of customers just waiting to get these new products, and you're going to see a significant step up in revenue, bookings and revenue, 6 months, you know, assuming there's no additional delays. Am I right in assuming that you'll see a very significant step up in bookings and revenue in 6 months if you don't see any additional delays?
We, as I said earlier, last quarter and reiterated at the beginning of this call, we see increasing bookings and increasing revenues as far as the eye can see. It's not been the case, as far as I can remember, that we would, as we recently have had to do, you know, in effect turn away opportunities because we have more customers and more requirements coming to us that, in spite of all the efficiencies that are brought about by our unique methodology, that we can address. So we become more and more selective with respect to the threshold of business opportunity and commitment to pursue new kinds of customers and applications.
Great. I'll get back in the queue. Thank you so much. Sounds good.
Your next question comes from the line of Don McKenna. Please proceed.
Hey, Patricio. I don't want to beat the horse, you know, again, but and I do appreciate the fact that you're broadening the base of your customers. But can you explain to me why there's that delay? It is now 15, if not 18 months. Is it because they're not able to produce a reliable, functional product? Or have they lost market share to other competing products from other chip design people?
Well, so it's really not up to me to comment on what stands behind these delays. I think that that's a question that should be posed elsewhere. You know, we are, as our customers are, dependent on the availability of next generation solutions, and I think to your point, as time goes on, more and more solutions are becoming available, and there is pressure building for alternatives.
Have they not indicated why it is they have the continued delay?
Again, it's really not up to me to comment. There could be perfectly. I'm sure there are perfectly legitimate and valid reasons for these delays. I think I'm fond of the expression that people in glass houses should never throw stones, right? So every company that makes, you know, disruptive technology a core element of its strategy will from time to time suffer delays. You can't have your cake and eat it too. I mean, if you want a high degree of predictability, by definition, you're taking baby steps that are highly predictable, but they come at the expense of not enough innovation, which ultimately is key to long-term success. So, you know, Vigor is in the past, as you know, as we all perfectly remember, at its it's delays. We've had numerous delays, certainly when it comes to, you know, via chip products, as I go back a few years, because of the challenges inherently in the novelty of the technology, we saw developments slip by a year or two in some cases. The good news is that we got them past that phase, and I think as we've all seen, over the last year and a half, we've been able to introduce products at an accelerating rate, and that's the trend that is continuing because we transitioned from, you know, a certain phase in development of brand new technology to a different phase in which we can apply it with a higher degree of predictability, was still leveraging the unique attributes of very disruptive technology. It's a different phase. It's really not within my competency to be able to opine on what may stand behind the VR-13 delays. I'm sure you can you can find explanations from other sources.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Dick Feldman. Please proceed.
Hello? Hello?
Dick Feldman, your line is open. Please proceed. Your next question comes from the line of Alan Hicks. Please proceed.
Yeah, good afternoon. I had a couple of questions on some of your other markets, specifically supercomputing, automotive, and wireless telecom. What are your opportunities there?
So supercomputing, we are getting more and more involved. By the way, unfortunately, one of the supercomputing applications is VR-13 based, so that is also, you know, suffering from the same delays. So that's an example of a point of load supercomputing application. We're also involved in supercomputing applications from a front end perspective. There are two, you know, major initiatives on that front that come to my mind in answer to your question with some of our front-end products. So on the supercomputing front, we're making inroads both at the point of load and in terms of front-end solutions. Was there another market that you asked?
Automotive and wireless telecom.
Okay, automotive. So in the automotive space, we, you know, we're selling DCMs, and this program that is ramping in China with our 4623 DCM chip, multiplicity of chips per system. We're also involved in other programs, and in some cases I can't comment about the specifics because of confidentiality constraints, but I can tell you that they are exciting programs, and ones that have great potential in years to come, particularly when it comes to autonomous driving systems.
And the wireless telecom?
So in wireless telecom, we have some important, one particularly important design win with our PFM in Asia. So that's, again, an example of a different kind of product with a different end market, a different type of opportunity, but still leveraging those common denominator capabilities in terms of engines and packaging technology that I was referencing earlier.
Okay, and finally, your BBU business, do you think that's back on the growth path, or is that still going to be kind of flat?
So the BBU business should be viewed in terms of legacy products, which, you know, as Jamie pointed out in his remarks, you know, do tend to be particularly dependent on the microeconomic cycles, and they're also very much dependent on defense cycles. But there's a new breed of opportunities that are enabled by DCMs and other chip and VIA products that we have been introducing within the last year, year and a half. Registrations of new applications with respect to these products are growing very rapidly, and they clearly point to a time frame in the next few years where the mix of business in terms of the center of gravity of what was historically legacy BBU business, you know, will have shifted progressively towards the new products, which, needless to say, offer much greater density, much greater efficiency, you know, better cost effectiveness, and, you know, in combination with a number of other improved performance attributes. So we are continuing to enjoy the steady revenue and profitability of the legacy bricks. You know, don't get me wrong, those are not going anywhere. But the good news is that we're also building on top of that a new set of applications with the existing traditional BBU customer base and with some new customers enabled by the new products.
Okay, sounds promising. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of John Dillon. Please proceed.
Patricio, I wanted to talk a little bit more about some markets also, in particular the communications market. I think what I saw is the OCP actually supported the 48 volts or brought it into the OCP for communications. And as you know, I'm not sure everyone else does, but communications has always been 48 volts. So how is that market embracing you? How are you doing in that market?
So while it is true that communications historically relied on a 48-volt bus, communications for the last, 15, 20 years has used that bus through a so-called intermediary bus, or intermediate bus of 12 volt. And while 48 volt has been the backbone of communication power distribution and power infrastructure, virtually all of the sockets in recent times have not been provided by way of 48 volt to point of load converters. Virtually all of the sockets have been supported by 12 volt to point of load converters. And that is changing. And remarkably, companies that historically have been very entrenched, you know, very comfortable in their paradigm of 48 volt, 12 volt to the point of load by way of a bus converter followed by an isolated point of load regulator have recently made an agonizing reappraisal of what it takes for them to be able to compete and be able to make systems that have the requisite density and efficiency. You know, fundamentally, need is a catalyst for innovation, and I think a combination of desperate need for greater density and efficiency coupled with some of the public pronouncements that took place earlier this year have caused mountains to move that I would never have thought would be moving as fast as they are away from the 12 volt intermediate bus and the intermediate bus architecture. I'm not suggesting that this is going to be a change that will take place overnight, but it is indicative of a broad change that is taking place now across, you know, different end markets, and will a change that will cause greater opportunity for 48 volt solutions direct to the point of load with greater economies of scale and greater performance. It is self-reinforcing, and it is indicative of a trend that should bring about significant changes in the power system architecture across these different markets.
So it sounds like this is a situation where success will beget more success because they're seeing your success in other markets with 48 volts and they're starting to adopt it. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that's an element, but there's also another catalyst which has to do with just need. You can't keep solving communications, power systems challenges by, bus converter bricks and point of load regulators. So if we look at what has happened over the last 10 years, it used to be that the typical motherboard was powered by bus converter bricks with a capability of hundreds of watts. And these boards, over the years, have gone from consuming hundreds of watts to consuming 500 watts to consuming 700 watts to consuming over 1,000 watts, and that trend keeps on going. And the requirements in terms of bus converter building blocks and point of load regulators keeps getting more and more challenging to the point that system designers can no longer solve their requirements with the same old solutions, even accounting for the evolution of those solutions, meaning, the bus converter technology has gotten better over time, but it's at the point where it no longer works, and part of the reason has to do with the inefficiency of the intermediate bus architecture in terms of its power distribution losses and other factors. So the reason why these changes are taking place more and more and across different end markets has to do in part with emulation and in part with need. And it's a combination of the two that provides a powerful catalyst.
Great. Are you seeing design wins then? Are you seeing many design wins in the communications market?
We're seeing design activity that I think will take some time to turn into design wins. But I think it's fair to say that that's a land of opportunity for our solutions because, once again, we are very uniquely equipped in terms of both our power conversion engines, our functional building blocks, and our chip capabilities in particular to address these needs with the highest performance, with at least a factor of two greater density than anything else that is competitive, and with, better figures of merit in terms of key parameters such as low noise and other attributes. And another development that is worth referencing here because it bears on all of this is that we're seeing more and more requirements for solutions in terms of the point of load devices, processors, other kinds of ASICs that demand 0.7, 0.8 volt rails at 200, 300 amperes. That kind of requirement cannot be effectively addressed in a rational way with the same kinds of solutions that have been deployed in the past. It calls for both a more advanced architecture and better engines. So two things have to change to address these kinds of requirements: the architecture and the engine in terms of the capability to deliver, in particular, a car multiplication function at the point of load, which is what, in one way of looking at it, sets us uniquely apart from everybody else.
Just one last question, and that's how about the graphics market? How are you doing in that?
Very well there, too. Designing activity going on that front as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Sounds really exciting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Dick Feldman. Please proceed.
Patricio, you mentioned that you have gotten orders and are addressing markets that are not tied to the 13 server. I wonder when those markets can start to be significant enough to start to move the needle if there were to be further delays with the new server chip.
Well, these other opportunities, and again, there are many of them, and there are different stages, are the basis for our general confidence in the growth opportunity, irrespective of the ultimate timing of the R13. I'm not suggesting in any way that the R13 isn't going to come around. It will. It's just a matter of exactly when, and obviously our past expectations were based on the information, the best information that was available to us, and that information in hindsight turned out not to be, you know, accurate. There have been numerous resets, but I don't expect that this is going to go on, you know, forever. I think at this point in time, whether it's the first or second quarter, or worst case, the third quarter of next year, VR13, as far as we're concerned, with the particular SKUs that we need to address and the power system requirements that we will provide, they'll come around. And when that happens, we expect to see a turbo effect on the growth that should otherwise be more and more based on a broader set of opportunities that are percolating along in complementary end markets with complementary products.
So what you're saying is some of the new markets you want to enter are tied to the introduction of the new chip, or are there things that are independent of all of this that
there are many
provide
things,
some growth?
Sorry for interrupting, but there are many things that are totally independent of VR13 that are progressing along. So VR13 will be a significant boost as it ramps. But if, let's say hypothetically, for whatever reason, I'm not suggesting that would be the case, if it would never to happen, which again, I would not expect to be the case. I think it's only a matter of when, not a matter of if. But even if it did not come about, we'd still be looking at the growth story with respect to the complement of products that we've been developing and getting designed in into a variety of end markets and applications.
The design wins that you have gotten, when do you anticipate that they would start to go into production in a meaningful way?
Well, so as an example, you know, in answer to the earlier question regarding you know, supercomputing applications, familiar with a design win, you know, for front-end components that will amount to millions of dollars worth, or is projected to be millions of dollars worth of business, you know, next year, and ramping further into 2018. So it's a long list of different products, different customers, different applications, different end markets. And they're all at different phases of gestation.
One last question. You made some comments on your call, earlier in the call, that you were deluged with customers making inquiries about using these products that you feel you have to be perhaps more selective in what you, who you can address? I wonder if you could give us further insight into that comment.
Yeah, so it is apparent to us that it has become apparent to many OEMs that their challenging power system requirements can in some cases only be addressed by Vicor power components. Even companies that historically we have found difficult to penetrate for a variety of reasons have recently come to us looking to engage us to have products designed to meet their needs. So I'll give you, without mentioning a name, an example in the communication space. Very substantial company, Asian company, that's come to us with a very unique requirement, and they believe we are capable with our technology to address it in a way that cannot be addressed otherwise. So we've engaged with them to address this requirement. We have been approached by other companies, and what I'm referencing here is all things that have happened within the last 6 months, a number of different engagements that we've taken on, and other opportunities that we have selectively chosen not to pursue because they were deemed to be, even though interesting in many respects, given other opportunities that we can pursue, not worthwhile. What I see into this is a growing realization by OEMs in a variety of end markets, and in some cases, some of the competitors have also come to us for help, that our technology, because of its very high density, high efficiency, flexibility, and general capability, can address needs that are highly leveraged in their own specific ways, and in fact, they want us to be part of the solution. I think it is symptomatic of, again, a growing realization of our capabilities, which bodes well for our opportunities going forward. It gives us the privilege of being able to select and choose what we have interest in going after, and that's a good place to be.
Okay, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you. If there is one more question?
There are no further questions in the queue.
Very well. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect and have a great day.